Supernatural, scene 36, take one. Marker.
Action.
Hello, my children.
The Crossroads contains explicit language and discussion. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
You son of a bitch.
Storm's coming. You boys, your daddy, you are smack in the middle of it.
Good morning, Vietnam!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Supernatural The Crossroads. I'm your host, Thomas Cowley, and I've got Ryan Denton with me.
Sup?
And Michael Flores.
Hello.
And we are back with a continuation of our previous discussion, in which we were diving deeper into the work of writer and eventual showrunner Sarah Gamble. She has been a fan favorite here amongst us in this room. And if you're new to Crossroads, you probably don't know this about us, but we absolutely love her work. We think she is one of the best writers, and especially back in the day with seasons 1 through 5, which any Supernatural fan, I would think, will agree were the hallmark seasons, the pinnacle of the show. Not that there weren't strengths later and weaknesses, but season 1 through 5 was where it really shined.
And to be perfectly fair and honest, we didn't always view Gamble this way.
It took time for us to
go back and rewatch things with a fresh eye. And what we ended up seeing was the complete opposite of what we originally had thought. And that was, what, 9 years ago?
Yeah, when and it's the same thing with, like, even with season 7. Like, we were the same, like, we used to be like, ugh, season 7. And then as we got farther
in, there are more redeeming qualities about season 7. Yeah, and
it's so wild.
And behind-the-scenes stuff revealed some of the pitfalls of that time, too. Yeah.
I think it's really wild that as time sets in, you're like, actually, you know, this is quite good. And, like, she has written some pretty freaking awesome episodes that we've already talked about. And,
you know, this is one of those occasions where we actually do change our thoughts.
It's called eating crow. Yeah. Is essentially what we're doing.
I know we're accused oftentimes of
being shitheads,
kind of, you know, digging in and refusing to change our views on certain things, which I don't agree with.
Well, I find it interesting that this fandom is one to say that.
That's a wild assessment.
Yeah. But yeah, it did take time. And what we're doing with this show right now is we're going into a little bit of a deeper dive this year on various different showrunners, what their strengths were, what was eventually their special ingredient that made their time on the show so important.
Their special sauce.
Their special sauce, if you will. And with this installment, we're talking about Sarah Gamble, her ability to craft compelling, character-driven stories, some of the most heart-wrenching episodes and some of the most iconic moments in the show have come from her. And she's gone on to do great work. We weren't personally, I believe, with the beginning that we saw of it, fans of The Magicians, but I'm a big fan of You. I know Mike has seen that show as well. And she's moving on to consistently bigger and better things. So we always wish her the best. But with the last installment, we talked about some of our personal favorite episodes. And now we've done things like this before with our Patreon discussions where we've talked about different specific writers, specific directors, what their strengths were and hallmarks. If you guys are ever interested in more content, you can find all of that over on patreon.com/Rainman Digital. We have a shitload of content over
there. That's the easiest way to describe it. Yes.
In the last year, probably more than we had just free content has been on Patreon.
Yeah.
By a wide margin.
I think overall, when I was going through our Patreon content last week, I think we have nearly 500 pieces of Crossroads content.
What?
That we've posted.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here.
10 years, man.
A lot.
Holy fuck.
Yeah.
There's a lot of incriminating shit on those 500 episodes. Holy.
You know, and how.
God dang.
It'll be deleted soon when I start looking for a new job. So get it while you can.
All right. So with the previous discussion, we talked a bit about some of our favorites. Now, it was too challenging, we felt, at the initial go rate these as a 1 through 5. So this became more of a free form discussion. And it naturally, as we are accustomed to do, especially if you're a longtime listener, went way over time. This is back when we used to have 3-hour shows on average.
Fuck, man.
You know, I miss those days in just a little bit.
I do a little bit too, because I feel like when we were in those 3-hour discussions, we were really so excited.
Yeah.
And so youthful.
Naive. Young.
Hopeful.
Optimistic.
And I do at some point miss being in here with you guys for 3 hours, even though we still are somehow in here for 3 hours, but just not a 3-hour show. I do miss those days. Nostalgic.
It was a special time.
It was.
But we went over with our last discussion, so we only got through a few of our top five. For a bit of a recap, we had all selected season 1, episode 12, Faith, which should surprise nobody.
No shocker there.
At this point, especially if you've been listening to our retrospective reviews. Ryan, you actually also had Heart, which you and I agreed on.
Yep, of course.
And
Mike
then
had it too, but he decided that was one he was bougie about and kicked off the list.
Yes.
Yeah, and made another.
And he had Fresh Blood, season 3, episode 7, on his list. And then you actually also got another one with out with Dead in the Water, the third episode ever.
Yes.
So we have two more from Ryan, three more from Mike and myself. So I'll kick things off here with my number three. And I will say this is hard.
These were very difficult, very challenging. Yeah, she's done some
to narrow
amazing
down.
Episodes, yeah.
But I would say for me, another one that I absolutely love is one I don't think people think about a lot, but is incredibly impactful, I feel, for the time in which it came out, which was season 3, episode 12, Just in Bello. And this was the culmination of the Detective Henriksen storyline.
Oh,
and this was also one of the things that I loved about strong writing is it essentially takes place in a single location.
I forgot about Henriksen.
We have what feels like both a mid-season finale and a mid-season premiere. And this was in a time in which the writer strike of 2007 and 8 had occurred. And really hindered every show across the board, leaving Supernatural with only 16 episodes. But this had Henriksen's storyline come to an end. We have the group sold out by Bella, of all people. We have Sam and Dean trapped trying to save people in a prison. Demons are assaulting the grounds. There is no escape. It's a very, very bleak setup. It is very reminiscent of things like The Mist, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, things where your options are limited and the only way it looks like this story ends is for it to truly end. There is no light at the end of the tunnel. There is no hero coming. And having our characters trapped in this scenario, I thought was brilliant because it not only helps show Henriksen that they were not in fact villains, that there's a bigger world at play here, that they are dealing with a lot more, but you have even Dean gets wounded in this one. Like the stakes are just constantly rising it's such a tight script because not a minute of it is wasted. And I think the absolute killer of this is that despite them coming up with a way to send the demons back and having this kind of Hail Mary plan work out, and Henriksen is now on their side. They've theoretically built a new ally. He's going to say that they were killed in the chopper explosion and wipe the slate clean.
Right.
They have saved people. It's a victory. And then right at the end, everyone dies. That was such, I mean, wow, what a fucking way to end that. You did all this work. And I think what I loved about this episode was not only was I captivated the whole time, but it really makes you feel like Sam and Dean or like a hunter right there with them. Dean's clock is ever ticking down. We are in a limited situation. We have not only our human adversaries, but the demon adversaries now trapped in a situation where the stakes are low and the resources are lower. Or stakes are high and the resources are low.
I think the thing about like these episodes and even Henriksen's arc it was always a feel of like, how the fuck are they going to get out of this?
Right. It felt realistic too.
Yeah, it really did. And I think that's where like this, that episode, your episode, Thomas, is like, it felt real.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like I always felt like, you know, if Supernatural, a show that clearly is about air quotes, supernatural, can make me feel like something is realistic, then I'm like, okay, I'm sold. I'm in. Right. I think, and that's what I think when I, cause I was a late bloomer to this series when we started doing this, like that's what really hooked me in those first couple, you know, episodes was like, even the first couple seasons, I was like, oh shit. Okay. So I remember this episode. It just felt, real. Like the stakes felt real for a change, which mm-hmm. is usually not, I don't know. It's different. It's.
Yeah. I, this is actually on my list too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There we go.
Hey. For other reasons as well as everything Thomas just said, but just digging in deeper into the content itself, it goes to show you how Gamble really likes to use like moral dilemmas.
Yeah.
Oftentimes
she's good at it.
Yeah. She's very good at it.
The title of the episode itself, Jus in Bello or Jus in Bello, however you pronounce it, it is Latin and it stands for justice in war. And it encompasses the moral principles guiding the conduct of warfare. And the reason why that's important is simply by watching the episode, you realize that the entire thing is positioned to create moral dilemmas for Sam and Dean. So Gamble did what she does best, and she writes those complicated stories. Like what we said during our last discussion, she digs in very deep into the human condition, and she unravels or unearths, I should say, those particular things that we don't really want to know at times, how our heroes will handle certain decisions. Gamble did with this. She used it to highlight the moral integrity that both Sam and Dean adhere to, even in moments of extremely violent conflict, creating this ethical dilemma that poses questions pertaining to the acceptable, and this is the key here for me, the acceptable collateral damage in the pursuit of justice, because you have the Winchester's refusal to sacrifice Nancy the virgin, which is an example of this. Ruby offers them a solution. It's a spell that involves the sacrifice of a virgin. They rebuke her. She takes off. And then you have Gamble's ability to weave high risk with metaphors of warfare and attrition and allows the audience to actually take notice through the eyes of Agent Hendrickson. This is why his character is so
pivotal,
so awesome for this specific part of the episode, because at this point he was a disconnect. He wasn't really seeing Sam and Dean through our eyes. Yeah. At this moment, he finally witnessed Sam and Dean's actions through the eyes of the audience. And that, you know, this rejection, you know, so-called acceptable attrition, the Winchesters embody a more principled approach to warfare. That's why I love the title, because that's a lost art. When television used to use titles to explain to the audience
if
you pay attention, this has some meaning here.
It's funny you say that, because my next two are very similar with that, with the name of them. But I think what's interesting about what you said, Mike, is that the moral dilemma of the acceptable casualty in war.
Yeah.
Right. Is such a huge thing that I feel like writers play on a lot, because of, well, I can kill one to save a million, or it's very consequential. Yeah. And it's, and you put the stakes at, you know, saving the world or whatever it is, and you make that choice, and it's not an easy choice.
No, it's not. But that's why I find these particular episodes extremely interesting.
Yeah.
Because even if you look at Gamble's overall body of work, some of her best episodes involved these types of moral questions. Most of season 6 is composed of deeply intricate moral dilemmas.
Yeah.
Look at Castiel's storyline in season 6. Look at Samuel Campbell's storyline in season 6. She's all about moral dilemas.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing too, though, is she's good at doing them.
Yeah.
Which there is a lot, especially with the superhero genre, there is a lot of attempt at moral dilemmas that are not moral dilemmas in the fucking slightest.
Yeah.
For example, a movie that I'm not a big fan of, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. The idea that sacrificing one person to save the multiverse, oh, we can't do that. Horse fucking shit. One person for the multiverse is a no-brainer to anyone because you can't save that one person if the multiverse dies or is destroyed or controlled or snapped away, whatever it is. There is such a stake on the other end that the scale is never going to move and be in question. But here, it is not that level. It is one virgin worth the lives of these other three, four people?
I mean, I'm not getting rid of a virgin.
Are they willing to sacrifice an innocent person who might herself be willing to do it to save their own skin? And at this time, they're not chosen ones.
Defucks her, problem solved.
Okay.
We don't look at a virgin.
What's that? We need a virgin? Ah, too bad.
That's another moral dilemma.
No virgin.
That's another
no virgin one. Now. Oh, you need a, what kind of virgin do you need? Like a butthole virgin?
Oh, okay. And that's the thing,
I'm
though.
I'm an anal virgin.
It's a scale that's realistic. I can
see Veronica Price say something like that.
She's not. She's not.
No, she's, so. Yeah, she's absolutely. If you guys want to know what we're talking about, go to
Patreon.
Head
on over to Patreon.
Yeah.
There is a scale there that is realistic, and it also puts us in our main characters on the other side. We don't want to lose them, so that puts us immediately on the side of, well, maybe we should sacrifice this one girl. But also, it questions their morality in a way of, are you worth saving? Is Henriksen and these other innocent people worth saving at the cost of one? Or do all of you die? But again, it's only like five people at this time. And they're not the chosen ones. This isn't apocalyptic yet. This is simply, not even simply, I mean, the demons are bad, but Dean's already on his way out at this time.
Yeah.
So there's all these other elements that make it genuinely a moral conundrum rather than it's so obvious that you have to sacrifice one person to save existence itself.
I like your comparison to the Doctor Strange film. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have a problem with that movie like you do. However, your point is very clear, and I agree. We are in this weird era when moral dilemmas aren't quite moral dilemmas, because we used to be a society built on this idea of utilitarianism, which is consequentialism, where it is about the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Now we've exchanged that for a type of virtue ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, virtue ethics has its merits.
But now it's a need of the individual outweighs the need of the many.
And for the purposes of entertainment, you know, pop culture, comic books, books, movies, television, it's not fun.
Well, I think like the other thing,
who wants to use virtue ethics in a TV show? That's not fun.
But that's
moral
the thing, they
dilemmas. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's my point.
Yeah.
I'm trying to tack on to your point. It's just not fun. It doesn't work.
No, it does not work. And on top of that, there's a whole entire generation of writers that are terrified of scaring the audience or upsetting people.
Yeah.
Like the very idea of you have to sacrifice the virgin and it's this girl, that's going to upset some people.
I don't even think they would say
virgin
in the later seasons of Supernatural.
No. That's
or
the thing.
Let's sacrifice a virgin.
Or they'd find a way in which you don't have to sacrifice. She just has to cut her hand a little bit, or it would be some other cop out. This has clear defined. This is the parameters. These are the rules.
There are true ramifications either
consequences,
way.
Consequences.
Yep.
As opposed to what we see now, which is a lot of, well, you may have doomed an entire race to extinction, Captain Marvel, but somehow you're a good person still because it all worked out in the end in the Marvels. Like that's okay. So if nothing matters, then nothing matters. And Sarah Gamble was not somebody who did that. And what I also love about this script is that it is such a textbook great way of raising the stakes. You know, the escape of the helicopter is gone. The heroes are wounded. They lose power. They lose the phone lines. When the demons can't get in, they take people over. And now you can't just kill them or do anything to them because individual innocent people are victims now.
Nah, fuck them.
It constantly gets worse for everyone involved. And what was so soul crushing though was especially with the end when Lilith just destroys everything, all that hard work, all that moral questioning, all the moment of triumph and victory and feeling like you won taken away. And that's a great way to establish a villain who, especially after Yellow Eyes, was always going to play second fiddle.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely one of my favorite episodes.
I agree.
Damn. Two birds with one stone there.
We got Mike there too. So.
Nice.
All right, Ryan, you want to go with your fourth one?
Yep, you're rotating up into my fourth one. Okay, so I'm going to change it up. I know we've talked about a bunch of serious episodes and blah, 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 blah. But
how dare us?
How dare we talk about good episodes?
Or serious. I know.
I am a sucker for alternate timelines or realities or whatever, especially if they're done right and they're funny. So my episode is season 4, episode 17. It's A Terrible Life. Where Dean plays is Dean Smith. Sam is Sam Wesson.
I forgot about that.
That is a good episode.
That is a good one.
And I love this episode because one, I love episodes like this where you kind of play on the fun alternate reality. You know, and we were big fans of like later in the, you know, alternate Sam and Dean. I don't know why, but this episode was just really, really funny to me. I enjoyed.
I didn't realize she wrote this.
Yeah. Yep. She wrote this. And I think it's a complete 180 from what she usually writes. But it also showcases the best parts of Supernatural, the comedy, Sam and Dean being goofy, things that,
the mystic qualities,
the mystic qualities of Sam and Dean and just everything about the characters, and it just builds on the characters. I think that's one thing that we talk about, but we don't talk about enough, is that we've had these characters for 15 years, right? And episodes like this built the character in a different way. Mm-hmm. We're used to seeing Sam and Dean as badasses, right? We're used to seeing Sam and Dean hunting and this and that, but seeing them as goofy, almost, goofy takes on their normal is
dorky
so
versions.
Yes, is so cool.
To add to that, another thing that Gamble does so well, which is a part of this episode, and I believe we might have said this during our later discussions when we started to have problems with some of Jared's acting.
Yeah.
Not that he's ever bad.
No.
But we were using it as an example to explain that Gamble was one of the few writers to really make Sam work.
Yeah.
She wrote some of the best things for Sam.
This episode's really interesting because it doesn't really, it focuses more on Sam than it does Dean, even though the episode ends with Dean waking up from it. It focuses on Sam being the one that kind of leads what they're doing. Especially to like them learning about hunting and watching the ghost facers, and it kind of puts the spotlight on him. And I think you're right. I think she was really good at writing Jared playing Sam to a point where we were like, okay, I could see Jared or Sam leading at some point, right? Because it's usually when you look at, and this is just me, and I don't know how you guys feel, but when you look at the whole of Supernatural, Dean's the leader brother, and Sam's the smart brother. And I've always felt that way. And I think the only time I really didn't feel that way is when Sam was like, demon blood and a badass, whatever, right? But I've always felt like Dean was the one that always led the charge, the gung-ho charge. And Sam was always the reasonable one. And I always felt like when you look at the two, Dean was always the one that was in charge, right?
Yeah.
And I think...
So in this episode, you like the dynamic switch, the interplay.
Like the writing. I liked... Obviously, the other thing that you didn't see Sarah Gamble write a lot was comedy. And I think this...
And yet she does it so well.
She does it so well. And this episode is so funny. But it also has a really cool, it introduces, Zachariah at the end. And, it adds... It's one of those episodes that, technically I would assume this is technically a filler, but it's fun.
But it's a supernatural filler, which isn't really a filler.
And at the end, it introduces a character that is massive to the overarching story. So
is this the episode where they actually introduce Zachariah?
Yeah, it's his first appearance. It is. Yeah.
Wow.
And
Which, I mean, that's really why you picked it.
Yeah, probably. I really enjoy this episode. I think it's really funny. It's really enjoyable.
I agree. It's
definitely like one of those episodes that's like tongue in cheek for sure. You know, French Mistake kind of type episode. But it's, again, I'm a sucker for these episodes. And I think she just, again, she doesn't write a ton of comedy, but this one's really fun. And I think that's a lot of times Supernatural. We get lost in some of the allegories and the crazy, you know, euphemisms of all this spiritual and supernatural and all these things, right? But sometimes it's just really fun. And I think that's what I really like about this episode.
That's the reason why Supernatural lasted as long as it did as well. I mean, it's because it's the perfect combination of all those things you mentioned, because it knows how to take itself serious, but it also knows when it needs to
make fun of itself,
introduce some levity and not take itself so serious.
That's why, I mean, this is the only goofy episode on my list, but I use the word
goofy. It's a good episode.
Yeah. So that's why it made my list.
All right. All right, Mike, we're coming to you then for number four.
Oh, okay.
Or your number four.
Season 6, episode 1, Exile on Main Street. The reason why, again, it has to do with everything Ryan doesn't like, but to me, this episode never receives enough recognition when discussing Supernatural for a lot of reasons. This was a start of something new. Kripke had gone away. And I think a lot of people just look back unfavorably on Gamble's run as a whole. And I think that's why when you think of some of the better episodes, a lot of people just veer away from season 6 and 7. And I don't think that's a fair assessment or a fair thing to do, because there's so much in season 6 that absolutely is solid work. And I believe the introduction of this new chapter is a part of that, or is one of those great things that Gamble did during season 6. And a lot of that probably has to do, as I said, with the overall feelings people have about Gamble's incomplete run. However, the episode is a textbook example of Gamble's skill set as a writer. For one, and I'm going to keep it brief, it essentially serves as a reboot for the series. If you're going to reboot a series without starting a new series,
It's a soft reboot. Yeah.
Its narrative dimensions are vast. It delves into the depths of the human condition again, where Gamble uses symbolism or perhaps a type of narrative displacement by employing the djinn, if you guys remember that, who are disguising themselves as normal people, much like Dean, who is attempting to live a normal life.
Yeah.
And by doing this, we get a critical examination of the nature of identity and the quest for authenticity in a world where individuals are often defined by their past and circumstances. So in this respect, the djinn symbolizes Dean's true nature. There is so much going on in this episode that people don't even pay attention to. You can try to disguise yourself like Dean, but in the end, he cannot escape who he is.
Yep.
Just like the djinn. You can also parallel this with Sam, who is also in disguise at this point. He has lost his soul, which also challenges the notion of authenticity. When I was reviewing season 6 recently, I noticed this entire theme began to emerge. It has everything to do with these concepts. As I mentioned a few moments ago, Castiel pretending to be something he's not. Crowley, Samuel Campbell, pretending to be something they are not. There's not a lot of honesty, but there are a lot of people in season 6 who are attempting to flee from who they are inherently, which goes right back to the nature of identity. That's why this episode stands the test of time for me and is one of the best.
It's an interesting episode because I remember the hardest part of this episode for me to watch was watching everyone tell Dean that they knew Sam was alive and watching Dean almost feel betrayed.
Oh, absolutely. That was sad too. That was heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking because it's like,
how do you not tell me you're especially alive?
Bobby knew.
Like
the fuck, dude. Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. But at the same time, I understand the characters not being honest with
Dean.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And, you know, they're always talking about, you know, well, if we had a normal life, and that was one of the most heartbreaking things to watch, because it's like, I understand both sides. It's that moral dilemma, right? Do I tell fucking Dean that Sam's back?
Do you rip away his happiness?
Yeah.
Life that was only pain.
Right. And it's very interesting because when you look at it, you're right, Mike. Like at the end of the day, he can't escape that he's a hunter. You can try and try and try, but you know, you're still a hunter.
Which fits in with your previous episode. Because the whole thing was showing Dean that he's a hunter.
He's a hunter, yes.
Also written by Sarah Gamble.
So this goes right back to what we've been saying or trying to come to terms with, because I still am trying to grapple with the simple fact that Gamble is a better writer than Kripke, because look at everything that's under one banner in her writing.
Mm-hmm.
And not just one episode.
Dude, her episode list is ridiculous.
It just across the board.
And we're not even my last one on my list. I'm surprised so far.
I've been saving my favorite.
This one is my favorite. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised, but I'll be interested.
So that's all I have for this episode.
I love that. That's a great episode. I mean, I don't dislike that episode. What did you mean when you said it has all the things I didn't say I didn't like that.
The things I was talking about.
No,
not a fan of the way I talk about episodes sometimes. That's what I'm
saying. No, because I remember this episode, and this was one of the, this was the other thing about this episode that's really wild to me, knowing what we know, right? That season 1 through 5 was supposed to be supernatural, right? This, like you said earlier, this was a really, really refreshing way to start a season that technically wasn't even supposed to exist. And to make us draw our interests back in, right? To go, okay, well, where the fuck do we go after the apocalypse, right?
And I think it's a great example of if you can't go bigger, you have to go more personal.
Sure.
And it's, you had the apocalypse, and now it's betrayal between Sam and Bobby and Lisa and Ben versus the Campbells.
It's so wild.
It's all, and Castiel's and Crowley are involved. It's all the personal relationships are in this muddied water.
Which makes, as a viewer, go, ooh.
And it gives you just as much compelling interest without it being, and then the world exploded again.
Sure it did.
You have to build up to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I do think this one gets, not necessarily flack, but it's that it's, I feel like it's one that's buried by other great work, both of Gamble and other people.
I see what you're saying.
That it's a strong episode, but it is hard to come off the heels of Swan Song, and it is hard to reboot something. And I think a lot of people just don't inherently like when Sam and Dean are at odds. And the idea that Sam and Bobby have lied to Dean despite their best intentions, it is one of the ones that it takes away from it a little bit in that respect, at least from a fan's perspective, even if it is written incredibly well.
Yeah.
So it is one that is often overlooked. Mm. It's one of many, right? Yep. So many episodes are phenomenal that are yet overlooked because there's just, so many of them.
It's a lot. It's a fucking lot.
All right. So for me, another one that I absolutely love comes from pretty much my favorite season. Season 5, episode 21,
God,
2 minutes to midnight.
That's on my list too.
Yeah,
that's my last one.
That's your last one. Fuck. I'm amazed by you. Okay. There's one that I'm amazed no one has said yet, but I'll get there.
Season 5, episode 21.
2 minutes to midnight.
So this is, this one's on my list because it might have, in my opinion, one of the fucking most badass fucking scenes where death is walking on the street.
Yeah.
To the
what
pizza
a fucking opening
with the music and just everything about it. Dude, that episode, that opening is so fucking sick. And just the slow-mo and just the song, our song playing, dude, so good. So good. That's why that's on my list.
It's an episode that has so fucking much in it. It's truly astounding. It has two of the four horsemen, one of which is dealt with in this, which is, when you read and you think about it, I've just always been absolutely in love with how Supernatural did the Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
It's such a good job.
I thought they were brilliantly executed, and it thought it did a great job of showing how famine and pestilence really are terrifying. You think of war and death, but the other two are just existential dread that you can't stop.
Die from what?
Yeah, and the way they had pestilence portrayed and just making every disease manifest. It had that biblical element of like locusts and death and decay. And then you have death itself. What a phenomenal opening. What a phenomenal actor to play the character who looks like death, like in the most respectful way possible to say. Like, you have this, like, what better time for your, you know, gaunt or skeletal, like, aesthetic of your acting physicality to come into play. Ugh. Like, it's beautiful. It had just enough mystery of him saying that he'd reap God one day. It has the Croatoan virus zombie people. It has multiple running narratives. It's building to the crescendo of the show. And it has Dean also sit across the table from death itself.
So fucking cool.
Eating, man. Snacks.
Yeah, eating pizza.
Like, only Supernatural can have this like grandiose cosmic mysticism. Stakes have never been higher. And also lunch and goofing off in a way. And it also,
someday I'm going to reap even God. Hold on, I'm going to take another bite of pizza.
Yeah, like, what?
Like,
wait, what?
That's brilliant. And also, I just loved the idea of the cage coming together, because the whole time I was watching it, the original run, I'm like, how are they going to stop this? And getting Death, who's pissed off because he's being his errand boy, like, it feels realistic. It doesn't feel out of your ass, contrived. You have Sam making his plans against Dean's wishes. You have Castiel, who's just a bum now. He's just a human, like, doing what he can. And he's the one who takes out Pestilence. Like, everything about it was just, again,
unhoused.
Constantly.
We call them unhoused now.
Oh, oh, was that it?
Yeah, Castiel was like a vagrant person.
Okay. It's just another great example of constantly upping the stakes. Crowley even gets his, you know, moment of time in the sun. Bobby sells his soul. This is the second to last episode.
Dude, it's fucking crazy.
Of the show. Dude. And you're like, what the fuck is happening? How do you get all of this in 44 pages? There's full on feature films and 9 episode Netflix and various streaming shows that can't hold a candle to the amount of content and character that is on display here. And this is one of those ones where it's something that I think of just the best writers in the business, and it's people like Harold Ramis, where it's, if you take every single line out, action and dialogue, that is not absolutely fucking necessary to convey a character, a motivation, or a plot point. And it's just haunting with the death alone is just a great fucking intro.
Fucking crazy.
And it's one that we all know and all remember. And it's one of the ones that I would absolutely say, if you don't watch this and you're not interested in the show, first of all, why are you starting here? But regardless.
And also, don't ever speak to me again or look in my direction.
Yeah.
If you don't like this episode, there's something fucking wrong with you.
Take a walk down Gaza Strip. I just don't care.
Oh,
whoa.
It's political now.
Whoa. Holy fuck.
But this just felt like such a great way to wrap up so many threads as we... And what I think is really shining about this is it ties so many narratives into one succinct point, to where we go into the finale and we know it's the end game. We know it's the final bit.
Countdown.
Everything else has been taken care of or accounted for. And it's just hats off to her. It's a great, great episode.
It made my list too. And like, arguably, it's not that we rank these, but it's definitely one of, like, if not my favorite on the list. And it's interesting because, like, the whole, I think it's just a mix, like you said, Thomas, of everything that happens in this episode. But the opening shot, dude.
I agree with everything you guys have been talking about. I also want to add that, just, you know, as a cosmology fan, you know, world building, this did it for me.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
As we have said so many times during our discussions over the last 10 years, Supernatural was doing shit that people were not doing on television. This type of world building, you are right. This type of proper world building is just not done in the mid 2000s and very rarely done except in cinematic form.
Yeah. It's just sublime.
Yeah.
All right, Mike, one more from you. Because Ryan, we've knocked out all 5 years.
Damn. Hold on. You guys got to talk about something real
fast. Okay. The fact, too, I just kind of like the idea that she wrote the second to last episode, then Kripke writes the last, and then she becomes showrunner. Because that's the person
you
hand off the reins to. You have be your like layup it's assist.
Very, very poetic.
On the final. Yeah, it's great. So, Mike, we got two more from you, I think, and only one more from me. So let's go to you.
Okay.
What do you got?
My final episode that's on my list, and this might surprise some people.
This is Mike's bougie pick.
It's very simple. And the reason why I picked this episode is because Gamble had the balls to go there and do things that a lot of writers to this day just cannot do. It's called Killing Your Darlings.
Oh.
Season 7, Episode 1, Meet the New Boss.
Oh, okay. Not the one I thought you were going for.
Okay.
It's not the best episode in the ways of writing, necessarily. But in its motivational techniques for the rest of the season, and its ballsy move to remove a beloved player from the field. And it really does echo her entire like writing ethos of when it came to Supernatural, which was, hey, listen, the show's about Sam and Dean. Everyone else should just be characters that come and go. She was attempting to course correct something that accidentally happened with Misha Collins and was never supposed to happen. But because they loved him so much and he was a fan favorite and he was just such a great character, he ended up, I don't want to say he worn out his welcome. Mm-hmm. He just became a bit of what was the term we always used? He was Superman mentality.
It was Superman syndrome.
If you had an angel in your back pocket there at this time,
you could do anything.
Yeah, there's literally no stopping you.
Yeah.
So she wanted to create some problems.
She kryptonite.
Well, I think it was a great, as heart, you know, wrenching as it is, I think it's a great move because it was intended to reset things, take away this power player. You've lost your queen in this chess match.
Yep.
She gave us some of the best Castiel storylines of all time in season 6. She removed them. That's what writing's all about.
Well,
you boost this
writing is about giving me exactly what I want that doesn't challenge me in any way and has my characters never really face any obstacles because they're perfect.
The thing that that's really funny.
That's Marvel.
It's very, very true. The thing is with this is I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that when this was happening were really upset.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I was upset. I was emotionally bothered.
Yeah. But when you sit back and you look at this, it's taking, like you said, Mike, it's removing a Superman from the playing field.
A potential writing crutch.
Yes, exactly. And making it the villain, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And now, okay, now you had this thing, you had this angel in your back pocket. Well, now you're facing this problem, right? This is pretty normal writing. Like it's writing. You take the thing that has helped you get to where you're at and turn it against you.
Yeah. Do you remember how it felt though? Was it season 6 is when he started becoming bad?
Yeah.
I was so conflicted. Oh, and then when they removed him in this episode, it created a whole other level of conflict.
Yep.
But at the same time, because I'm a fan of writing, it did work for me in retrospect. When I look back, it was something that a lot of people are afraid to do. He was a major beloved character and she
turned him into the villain.
Yeah.
And then made him a sacrificial hero. Last moment. Death.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Forgot about that death.
So that's my 5 that's right there. Amazing. I'm done.
What was your, did I count wrong?
Mine was Faith, Fresh Blood, Bellow, Exile Main Street, and Meet the New Boss.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, there we go.
All right. Well, that leaves me then with my last one, which I'm amazed nobody has said. Okay. I'm truly shocked by this. But for me, this one was one of the most emotional, one of the most painful, one of the most well-written and something that beyond Supernatural is a bit of media that will stick in my mind absolutely forever over other movies, shows, games, books, doesn't matter, because it was such a gut-wrenching yet heartfelt moment. And that was season 7, episode 10, Death's Door.
Mm-hmm.
Saying goodbye to Bobby.
Oh,
fuck.
Dude, I'm
killing
starting to get
another
I'm
character.
Starting to get choked
Holy
up
shit.
Right now. Like, what a, that's why I think I love her writing. Yeah. And I think she is a little bit better than Kripke in a lot of ways, because she's not afraid to go there. She's not afraid to, as you said, Mike, kill your darlings, a very famous writing quote. Nothing sacred. No one has plot armor. It's just what is happening based on character's decision and the plot that has to be played out. With the death of Bobby, that was such a fucking painful moment. But the way this episode is done, not only is a beautiful send-off, a clever way to have someone who's in a coma be the main character, but it also gives you the reveal of... gives you the reveal of Bobby's background with his dad.
Yeah.
And so much darkness, so much pain. You have Rufus shows up in this one. It was so impossibly hard. And I knew this was coming. Like, as I'm actively watching this live, I know this is coming, but I'm fighting it. I'm denying it every step of the way that we're going to have to say bye, not only to a beloved character, but the boy's surrogate father, more so arguably than John for a good chunk of their lives, especially their adult lives. And the way in which they had him protect his mom from this abusive dad that sets him on this path that makes you care about him so much more right before they take it away. But the part that still just rips my fucking soul out is when I'm seriously trying not to get choked up about this, but when he has his final memory of Sam and Dean just sitting on the couch talking about snacks with the movie.
Yep.
And he said, you know, save the best for last. Like, dude, you give a middle finger to a Reaper, to death itself, because he knew he had to stay to help them. Don't stop.
That's Thomas.
I'm getting emotional enough as it is.
Thomas is crying, guys.
He literally tells death and his chance at an afterlife of heaven and all that to pound sand because he wants to stick around and help them out. And that leads him down the path of being a ghost and a vengeful spirit. And that doesn't go well. But the ticking of the watch, even the final seconds, the cinematography behind it, too, is just... it's so painful. It's so fucking good.
I agree, because even like looking back at what they did with Bobby, I know there was a lot of gripes, even from our end, about what they did with Bobby. But I think the overall execution
was unsatisfying.
He technically did get executed.
I think so stupid. I think the overall execution of season 7 just didn't work as a whole because of behind the scenes issues. But
But
I have a feeling that if Gamble was able to fully realize her run, this whole Bobby thing would have been looked back on a lot more favorably, because you are right, Thomas, not only this episode, but even the episode, it's not written by Gamble, but it's set up by her when Bobby refuses to let go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's in season 7 too, under Gamble's leadership.
Well,
there's so much there, and you are absolutely right about the emotional level just being ratcheted up so high. Bobby was the father figure. This is also prior to
catch with Dean rather than have the they were shooting. John wanted them to go shooting.
Yeah.
And so he plays catch with them instead because he wants them to have that childhood.
Yeah.
And the fact that he doesn't want to have kids of his own because he didn't want to be like his dad. And then you see why, like,
the death mattered so much for many reasons, but also just retrospectively, this was before everyone
started coming
became
back.
The Winchester family. Family. Like, you barely met this person. She's not family.
I've known this guy in three episodes.
Fuck off. Family. No, you're not. That's
what they did in the later seasons. Yeah. They wanted to force this family dynamic, and they didn't want to work for it. This right here is a perfect example of why you need to work for it, because look how much emotion it elicits.
And I just love... just the way she incorporated the story with the concept and the setting. he's in a coma. How do you tell this story? It's memories and jumping through memories. And as his brain begins to die, he loses memories. The pages go blank. Rooms are missing. Things start to disappear. I don't know how many of you guys have seen Castle Rock, the on Hulu. It was a Stephen King inspired. Yeah. Do you remember season one with the woman who has Alzheimer's, that episode?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant fucking episode. I think this inspired that. Like, this is that kind of setup of how do you explain what's going on in the mind of someone whose mind isn't entirely there in a way in which it all ties together and is succinct. And like you said, the fact that this was back when you didn't have the entire, oh, you're our mailman. You're part of the Winchester family. Like, like, fuck off.
The mailman. We're pretty close.
USPS, you do good tracking. You're part of our family.
This is when it mattered. And her not being afraid to take away Castiel, Lisa, Ben, Bobby, fucking everyone.
She had a fucking hit list.
Dude, she had a hit list. But it's one of those things that,
fucking
like,
the bride over there.
It's one of those moments that I really fucking wish we had seen uninterrupted or unmolested what her idea for the show moving forward would have been. Had she been not kicked out halfway through seven, had she not had it cut short, I think it would have been just phenomenal. I think
her seasons would have rivaled Creepy.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what the writing room looked like when they walked in for the first, like, all right, guys, so here's the list. We're killing all these motherfuckers. What?
I love it.
It was good, man.
The whole writing room sounded like Thomas.
Yeah, dude.
What? We're going to kill Bobby.
And I think the other thing, too, is that she also gets into that moral dilemma because Dean and Sam want him around.
How's Castiel, Misha Collins, going to have a social media presence? Fuck off.
Like, Castiel served his time. But, like, the other thing, too, is, like, Castiel saying goodbye is rough, but he's an angelic celestial figure.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby is a dad.
Yeah.
Sadly, everyone's going to have to say goodbye to their dad at some point. Well, and this is written with the respect of someone who might have done that, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know her personal life, but goddamn, man.
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal. So that's my five. This is really fucking tough. These are some great episodes. But with that in mind, what we're going to do, besides cry about it,
or cry a little more,
what we're going to do moving forward, and Mike, correct me if I get any of this wrong, is we're going to rewatch these selected episodes, refresh them in our memory, and then come at this from what is she excelling at in all of these? What about her craft really shines through? What is the unifying elements of what makes a Sarah Gamble episode a Sarah Gamble episode from a scripting standpoint? And what are these things that would eventually go on to influence her showrunner capabilities with both Magicians and You, which were both very, very successful? I can't wait to see what she does next. I'm mad that she's leaving You before it ends, so I don't know about the final season of that.
You know, it's no wonder that she's the most successful showrunner that's left
this
show.
She's the best one.
Now, Kripke has the most iconic shows. Boys is a pop culture phenom. Supernatural was a pop culture phenom, but Gamble has the most consistent work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Followed by Carver, then Kripke. And then
that's it.
Yeah.
Where were you going to go with that one?
Well, if any of his shows had gone anywhere, maybe we'd have somewhere to go.
Imagine they get canceled before they ever get put in
Resident Evil.
Somebody just forgot me.
There was a show I was going to do, but it got canceled before I even got to an episode. Yeah,
you know,
how do you screw up Resident Evil? It's already B camp. It's so fucking hard to fuck that up.
It's so true. All right,
so that's going to do it here for us.
We almost got through an episode.
We can't. Wait,
no, we did get through one episode. We almost got through two episodes without being mean.
Almost. We're trying. Someday. It's a new year, you know?
Yeah. Someday we'll get there.
So with that, thank you all for listening, and we will see you next time.
Thank
you. You little maggot. You are no longer a part of this story. Hey, ass butt.